Circumstance, coincidence, blind luck or fate. They're the words our feature guest this morning chose to start his novel with. And they're also how he describes ending up in Aotearoa, New Zealand from fraught beginnings in his hometown in rural Canada. Ray Berard followed his partner to New Zealand, ending up working first in the horse industry, then at the TAB, supervising 50 gambling outlets. What he witnessed working in the gambling industry provided him with ample inspiration for his novel, Inside the Black Horse, about the armed robbery of a Rotorua tavern and the intersection of the lives it affects. Ray first published the novel himself, and it went on to win the 2016 Nio Marsh Award for Best First Crime Novel and to be longlisted for the 2017 International Dublin Literary Award. It's now being republished and has been made into a six-part series called Vegas, which starts on TVNZ's platforms next week. Ray Gerard is with us from our Christchurch studio. Very good morning and welcome, Ray.
Hello, how are you this morning?
I'm really well, thanks. You've made the move to Christchurch since the book was published, but you wrote this and really created this, I guess, while you were living and working in Waikato, yeah? Could you tell us a little more of the genesis?
I came to New Zealand, as you said, in 1994, and my partner was offered a job working on the hospital rebuild in Auckland. And, look, my mum had just died, and I was really sick of life in big city Canada. And I said to her, well, we'll go. And if after a year it doesn't work, we can come home. And, look, as soon as I got to New Zealand, I guess not having a Canadian winter, and I'm an outdoor person, I really fell in love with the place. But I had to reinvent myself. And my first job was working for a company that made gear for the horse industry and the racing industry, and that got me around New Zealand. And the TAB found me after a couple of years, and very quickly they made me sort of a supervisor in South Auckland. And I guess my genesis of writing came about to describe friends and family who were living in Canada. I started to write letters back to them. I just found emails and texts weren't going to do it. So I would sit down a few times a year and write almost like a short story about the things I saw and the places that I was working in, and the people, especially the Polynesian people that worked with me in South Auckland. And the habit of writing started to grow in me. It was something as a kid I loved, but as a kid it just wasn't going to be possible. And that writing of letters kind of morphed after an armed robbery at a TAB in South Auckland, where the policeman on site at the time said to me, look, Ray, this might take a year to get to court, and you should be very careful about the detail of what happened. It was an unusual thing, and he said, look, you know, because it's so long, just write it down. And that, I started to write a diary. And every morning before I would start work, at first it was just what was going on the day before, but it grew into kind of character studies, the people I saw, the events, and I guess that's where I started to see in my mind that I had this story growing in this diary of mine. And when I left the TAB in 2009, I was determined that I was going to write in the long form. I'd always loved writing, and the long form is kind of the master's degree, I guess, of writing. So I sat down and I banged out that first draft in about 18 months, and the hardest thing I think I ever did.
It's quite remarkable that your observation of an industry and then a place and then people that you just happened to find yourself working in provided such rich material. But the key part of this is that you were recording it. You were observing it. You were recording it. What were some of the things that happened that if they didn't directly inform the book, certainly opened your eyes to things?
Oh, look, I guess my childhood was part of that. I grew up in a very poor rural part of Canada, right on the U.S. border. And as a child, unemployment was 18 or 20%, more like 50%, I think, for kids. And it was really tough for young people to get anything. And the appeal of the gangs, the appeal of the enormous appetite America had for drugs. And at that time, much of the drugs coming into North America were coming through the ports of Montreal, and they were being smuggled over the border. And look, a lot of friends of mine, and I guess when I was in South Auckland around 2002, Junior Falili when he started, when, you know, he killed the pizza worker, Marcus Doing, and the bank teller, he also robbed four or five of our TABs at the same time, that same week. And I guess some of the backstory around some of the gang involvement, the methamphetamine showing up on the street, it really was a very stressful time. But it was about how the people I worked with, I mean, you know, there was one woman who was, you know, she was me, a female version of me, sitting in her TAB in Hillsborough, and, I mean, have a young man walk in with a gun. It was an enormously stressful, and I guess the feelings that she expressed to me after the event, I just thought it was something that was kind of important to kind of record. And that was the genesis of it. And then really from there, I wanted to write this very human tale about, you know, what those kind of events do to the people, all of the people.
There's more than one protagonist, but a key player, a key character in the story is Tony, who is a female running this bar and casino, the Black Horse. And again, is she drawn from a range of these experiences and a range of these characters?
Oh, absolutely. In Rotorua, I dedicated the book to a woman named Maxine. And Maxine was the manager of a pub in Rotorua. And very quickly, we got to be quite good friends. And she always found me unusual in that I like to share my stories of my youth. And so she would get a few of her friends, and we would sit down after work sometimes, and they would, and I would pick their brains about what they saw and did. And over time, she became kind of a window for me. Because, look, I am the first to admit that I'm a cultural novice. And my book was not about culture. It was more about economic circumstance, I think, and how economic circumstance creates people's lives. But I was painfully aware, of course, that everyone around me was not, you know, Pakeha from Canada. And Maxine was good. She was a kind of a cultural guide to what I could and couldn't do and say and couldn't say. And she also was great, after I left the TAB, of introducing me to people who were relevant to the story in terms of how they live their lives. You know, how does an old gang member live? And people that she knew. And I remember one night sitting in a house near Murupara with these two guys who were broken down old men, but they had great stories. And that kind of storytelling tradition in Polynesia is something that, I guess, being a young French Canadian, I really relate to.
So you're looking also at the humanities and the where and the whys of people who end up in these situations. And the book begins with a quite brutal beating, and you don't hold back on that. And, you know, a problem to solve, which is that a whole stash has been stolen by someone who's been tricked, and they've got to find the money. And do you come at this with the compassion of understanding, both from your own background and from what you've learned from the people you've met and shared these stories with, the circumstances that see us in situations we don't want to be in?
Look, it's a thing, and as a child, those kind of circumstances were completely normal to me. I think it was only really after the Army and when I was at university where my future wife and I met, and she would say to me, Ray, you don't need to get angry. You don't need to, because I had learned as a young man that that world is quite brutal. I was enormously suspicious. And later in life, of course, working in, when I would see the result of a crime, some kid would steal a wallet at a TAB, or there would be some incident where there was a robbery, you looked at the person committing the crime. And so often it's just a young man or a young woman who has just been in a situation where there is no more hope. And I guess it's the most dangerous thing, because when you get to the point where there is no options left, you become enormously dangerous human being. And sadly, I mean, New Zealand's not bad like in the United States, or, you know, but it happens far too often here as well.
How did you come to understand in more depth how the gangs worked here? Because every country, every culture has gangs, but they have their own particular dynamics. And again, was it Maxine and others who took you deeper and deeper into a realistic portrayal?
Oh, absolutely. Look, we had a joke in the TAB, and it's kind of a black joke that if I opened a TAB at Mount Eden Prison, it would have the best turnover of any TAB in New Zealand. And I guess, look, young people gambling, is most successful, and I'm not a gambler, and I guess I was hired by the TAB because of my understanding of the horse industry, but gambling makes its most money off people who are the most desperate. And in the most desperate areas of New Zealand, you generally find the most pokie machines, the most, sports and TAB gambling. And it's a reality, I think, that's worldwide. And I'm sorry, Catherine, I lost my train of thought on your question.
You'll have to ask me again. People who you took and who took you into their trust and who took into your trust.
Oh, yes, okay, sorry.
They were the ones who were able to take you deeper and deeper into how things operated here. That said, were there profound similarities to what you had experienced in the States? Because you mentioned you were just a few kilometres, I think, from the border, the Canadian US border. And, you know, did you see many of the same stories and many of the same activities?
Look, at the reality is exactly the same. When I was a kid, the local gangs were called Rock Machine, Le Gitan, Les Atoms, and they were the, kind of the feeders to the mob. And Montreal and New York mobsters were sort of interconnected families, and they ran the business. And the way the gangs work, and I guess in my own case, I feel very fortunate that I didn't go the wrong way. Young men who can't see opportunity in life, who work as hard as they can to get somewhere and really never get, the chances of university, of those things, they will generally start to make their own opportunity. How that happens culturally is different, and certainly among the Polynesian gangs in New Zealand, there are some cultural things. But sadly, look, only from my own experience, and I'm not an expert, the drivers that run those gangs work the same way. They're a club that you get involved in, and it's like a dog pack. You evolutionarily rise to the top or you don't make it.
So there's someone you had in particular in mind for Kingy, and tell us a little more about the Kingy character.
Oh, look, I had a guy who... I had a phone call from a guy who was, I think he actually lived in Whanganui, and he had lost a betting ticket. And it was a large ticket. He had won about $3,000, and the ticket, he had lost the ticket. And the rules in those days were he had to show up, and I could find when the bet was on and all of that, but the rule was, he had to show his face. And when I said to him, you've got to show your face, I'll meet you somewhere at a pub, and I'll check you out, and you check me out, and I'll give you your money. And he just went off his rocker on the phone to me about how he was going to kill me. And I said, well, look, whatever you want to say, you've got to come, and I've got to see you, and you've got to sign, and I'll give you your money. And so I went to this pub in Rotorua. I just started working in the Waikato. And I met him, and he was this enormous human being. And he was a very, very frightening-looking man. I think he was Black Power from Whanganui. It might have been Mungro Mob. And a few weeks later, I was running a promotion with a trotting driver in Whakatane. And he was there because he liked to bet on the trotters. And he would hide his gear and show up at these pubs. And no one bothered him because he must have been 7 feet tall. He was an enormous man. So I took his physical embodiment as kind of my image of Kingy.
The book also has a spiritual dimension to it, talk of dreams. And what was the strand of inspiration for that? Because a lot of what we've talked about was your lived experience, things you saw, people you met, things you grew up with. This more spiritual dimension, again, was that introduced by experience with others, or was there something else to it?
When I was a child, there was an Algonquin Indian guy who was a hired hand on a farm near where I lived, and he worked horses and helped me with my horse. I was just a kid. But he always talked about this kind of dream world, and I related that story to Maxine, and she talked to me, and some of her friends talked to me about some of that spirituality and about how dreams work in their culture. And it's always something fascinating. It's a nice way to take a bit of the hard edge off the story. So I like those dream sequences just to really not be quite so, a bunch of gang members all trying to attack each other. I didn't really want to write that kind of story. And it's something that really adds a great element to the fictional dream of the book.
Your experience of writing it, as we said, you'd been compiling the source material, your letters home, then keeping the diaries because the cops said, keep details of what's happened here. And weren't you scared, by the way, during a lot of what happened at this time, and you had significant responsibilities. You know, did you enjoy the job? Were you kind of innovated by it, or at times were you just downright scared?
No, look, I didn't. I guess being a growing up tough as a kid, I think the TAB knew more than I did that I was ideally suited. One of the very senior managers took me around South Auckland at the beginning and said, you know, Ray, well, you got to be careful here, and you got to be there, and you got to be here. But I had actually worked in the southern states for a few years in a job before I came to New Zealand. And I guess because your story before 10 o'clock about America and guns, I said to him, I said, well, no, these guys, you know, I mean, if you dropped 100,000 handguns in South Auckland, yeah, that's not going to be much fun. But the reality was, look, these are just people, and a vast majority of people who go in the bars, who go in TABs, it's their social life. They have their few dollars on a horse on the weekend, or they back the golf or the tennis. It's only, and of course, because you have 50 outlets, I would only see the ones who didn't cope and didn't make. So that 2 or 3% of people who, gambling becomes an addiction like a drug, or alcoholism or those things. And unfortunately, as the supervisor, that was the thing. But the job never really bothered me. What bothered me, I think, was this crazy paradox in all societies. Canada's exactly the same, where the government is the biggest benefactor of gambling. It's a strange paradox. And when I had the opportunity to leave, my wife needed someone part-time to work with her on the hospital build in Waikato. And when she gave me that opportunity, I said to her, look, I'm going to take 4 hours a day to write, and I'm going to walk out of this job, because after 12 years, I had had enough.
So in the end, it wasn't the people at all. It was the system that you began to look on with what?
Look, I'm not a gambler, and gambling is a strange thing. I love to look. I go to the races once in a while with friends, and my friends all like to have a punt on a Saturday at the pub. But I guess when you spend, it's like, and I have friends who are policemen, too long looking at the dark side is actually unhealthy. And by the time I left the TAB, I was well done with that. I wanted to be a better person, and I just really was sick of you know, being in court, seeing people's lives falling apart because of gambling, all of the issues that, you know, you'd be, Catherine, you're well aware of them as well. And for me, I wanted to do something, and look, it was funny, I'm grateful forever that I was ready, and I had the economic ability to write that book at that time, because 10 years earlier or 10 years later, it wouldn't have happened. And for me, it was my master's degree in creative writing, because the first draft, of course, as you know, is a great thing to do, but to take it from that to a professionally written, tight story, I imagined I was 70% done after the first draft when I was actually 30% done.
Ray Berard is our guest. Inside the Black Horse is the novel that has now inspired a TVNZ series, Vegas, that will be coming to TVNZ platforms next week, 27 minutes past 10 on 9 to noon. So you sat down for those 18 months and you wrote, and I mentioned earlier you had the raw material in the form of the diaries or the letters home, but when you started writing, did it just pour?
It poured out. It was I had help from a couple of New Zealand literary people after the first draft, and Barbara Els said to me, "It's kind of War and Peace, Ray, in Rotorua, because the first draft was like it would be twice the size of the book." But she said that's a good thing, because actually, it's when they come with half what they need is the hard thing. So for me, they helped me technically through the process. They were great. They never changed the story much. They just helped me to understand the technicality of writing in the long form, and look, for that I'm really forever grateful to Barbara and Chris for the work that they did with me to teach me, you know, how to portray the characters, what I should read to help. And at the end of it, I was well trained. I was well sick of writing at the time, I have to say that.
Then you publish, and self-publishing has been a bottomless pit of despair for many, many people have endeavoured it. But actually what happens for you is you start winning prizes. The 2016 Naya Marsh Award for Best First Crime Novel, very prestigious awards in this genre, and then longlisted for the 2017 International Dublin Literary Award. And, you know, what happened with sales? Like, what happened to this baby that you'd put out to the world?
When I finished, Catherine, when I finished the book, I was exhausted by it. The last few months, especially that really technical aspect at the very end of a book. And I knew, like, I'm a 50-something-year-old white guy, and I'm thinking, well, no one's going to really want to do that. And Stephen Stratford, who's a very good editor, he helped me. And he said to me, Ray, he said, this book should be in the public space. And I had put, he helped me to really make it tight. And I gave the book to, the manuscript to four or five people that I trusted. And they read it and they said, look, we think it's fantastic. So I said to myself, I print 1,000 copies. If I sell them, I'll make $10,000 more than it cost me to print them. And look, very quickly, to my amazement, because I always was doubtful of my own skill, the listener picked it as one of the books of the year to read. And I would go and do talks and people would buy books. And very quickly, the book was kind of gone. And I kind of moved on. I started to help my wife on the Christchurch Hospital rebuild. We had moved down here. But the book kept going and people kept contacting me. And then a fellow named Paul Murphy, who is Jeff Murphy's son, he's a director in Wellington. He called me and talked to me about doing a movie. And he was really serious about this thing. And I started to understand that, well, hold on, maybe, you know, this book has had an impact. And when Greenstone came to me, Harriet Crampton was amazing. She saw what I was trying to do. She saw the idea of the redemption tale and really very quickly had ideas about how this could be adapted. And look, great credit to them. There's a lot of people involved in these big television productions. And for them to all kind of say, well, look, this guy from Canada's book is what we want to do. It's a life experience that I'm enormously grateful, and it got me off my bum. And of course, I'm well into the second book now. Just being patient, though, because of course we want to see the first book have a proper release. And Bateman have been great. They've re-released the book, and as a writer, I will say to everyone listening, buy my book.
You know, every author manages to get that in, but not quite so directly. So no, look, honestly, you're just an honest guy, Ray, aren't you?
It's a good book. And look, everyone, your producer, she said to me the other day, she said, I really like the love story. And I was like, great, that's fantastic. Slice of life.
Yeah. Let's talk about the adaptation. Did you have much to do with it? Because for a start, Rotorua is not the the name. It's Wairoto that is the name. But there's some Vegas is a bit of a, you know, a bit of a hint. But did you have much to do with the adaptation, or did you say, right, hands off now, this is coming to the big screen? What was that process like for you?
Well, they signed the rights. Michael Bennett, who I had already met, who had won the Niall Marsh for nonfiction the year after I won it, he wrote the screenplay, and of course I knew about him from Outrageous Fortune. And look, I think they just did this amazing job. They let me read the screenplay. They asked me for some feedback. I told them that, for me, I was busy helping my wife at Christchurch Hospital. It wasn't possible for me to be involved, and I don't know if they would have. You know, they probably didn't need me. But I think they've done. We got to go to the welcome in Rotorua. The fact that they filmed it in Rotorua was very important to me. And the biggest thing was that they brought on all of these apprentices to learn the television and film trade, and I got to meet them and spend a day on set, and that was really, really an amazing experience for me. I love Rotorua. Look, and I don't know if I've got time here, but a newspaper reporter from Rotorua interviewed me and sort of said, you know, we're very staunch about Rotorua and we don't like to see Rotorua looking bad. And I said to her, I used to say to the young kids that used to give me a hard time at the pubs, I'd like to take them to Detroit for a week. And they wouldn't think Rotorua was actually very bad at all.
It's interesting. There's a lot of sensitivity now around Pākehā writing characters, Māori characters or Polynesian characters, or the same argument is held in the United States over writing, you know, a Mexican character or an African-American character. There's just a universality, perhaps, though, to the story that you tell. And now others are taking it to the big screen, right? You've got some heavy acting talent, very experienced acting talent, bringing it to the screen as well. Can there be a universality to a story that, if told with honesty and with compassion, can mitigate those awkwardnesses or concerns?
It's essential for our future, Catherine. I had one great fortune as a child. I was the son of a French-Canadian Catholic and an English Protestant mother. And I guess as a child, both of them were racially blind. I never thought, like in the Army, there were guys from all over the world with me in the Army. My university, there were 38 countries in my graduating class. I guess I was given the fortune, even though I'm a 60-year-old man, of not ever sort of seen people from that perspective. I never thought of, you know, that you're brown or you're yellow or you're white, or I didn't. And I'm actually quite thankful, because when I wrote the book, that never crossed my mind. And a lot of the women who worked with me in Rotorua, of course, and they were all Te Arawa, they were like, "You're amazing, Ray, because you don't see it. And they would say it, and I didn't even know what they meant. But I guess for me it was it's just something about the way I was raised, and I owe my mum forever that. It's not something that I think, and I think the world needs to move to that real quick smart.
The second book, different, yes, thematically?
Totally. It's, again, a New Zealand tale. It's a story about faith versus wealth that plays out in near future New Zealand.
The enthusiasm is infectious. Enjoy seeing your story coming to the screens next week. And thanks again for your time, Ray Berard. The novel is Inside the Black Horse. It has just been republished by Bateman, I think. Yes, Bateman Books. And the adaptation is coming to the TVNZ platforms next week. It's called Vegas.